You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 21st, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In Sam's throat.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Don't drink from the Gowanus Canal. On the program today, Jonah Furman, writer at Labor Notes, author of Who Gets the Bird newsletter on Substack. On the temporary strike-averting railway deal. Then Seth Harp, investigative reporter and contributing editor at Rolling Stone, on the overdose crisis at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And in the fun half of the program today, special debate with Brad Palumbo, journalist and policy correspondent at the Foundation for Economic Education, wherein I will get schooled as to why we shouldn't have, I guess now in the past, and maybe not in the future, forgive any student debt. Meanwhile, Putin calls up more troops, should say reservists, as Russia's invasion and war is faltering. First time since World War II. They have called up reservists. Meanwhile, the Fed set to sink the economy into recession, all to discipline labor. Civil rights firm representing the migrants, more or less hoodwinked by Ron DeSantis, files a class action lawsuit against Governor DeSantis. That's dumb, but I like it. Trump's Save America PAC reportedly spending lavishly on saving Trump from legal bills. And Vance and Ryan in dead heat in Ohio as McConnell's PAC decides to pack up and leave Arizona. Lindsey Graham's Republican federal abortion ban will all but require transvaginal ultrasounds to protect doctors from legal jeopardy. Next January 6 hearing scheduled for September 28th as the House looks to pass reforms to the Electoral Count Act to stop another Republican electors stunt. And Planned Parenthood centers in California are reporting an 847% jump in Arizonan patients since the Supreme Court ruling. Joe Biden to speak at the UN today, and Extinction Rebellion Boston activists arrested as they shut down Boston streets. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. It is, of course, the day that my co-host made famous with her very clever, and I'm finally just getting this now, too. What is it? Say your famous catchphrase for today.
It's hump day.
Yeah. It took a long time for me to figure it out, but it's in the middle of the week, Man. Just like a camel's hump.
An eagle hump.
I get eagle bumps when we think about it.
Yeah.
No, well.
Not a goose hump, no. An eagle hump.
I'm just waiting out for whenever this dies down, this fixation on me saying hump day.
But... You know what it was? It would have just all gone away if we hadn't gotten two emails out of the tens of thousands of people who watch this program or listen to it. We got two emails claiming that you did not coin that phrase.
Oh.
And that's enough for me to want to push it that
well, that's
you did
an affront
for years.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, now that you've bruised my ego, emailer to two emailers, it's hump day forever, bitch.
Well, part of the problem too is I have a psychological problem that when I see that like someone writes in and says, you know, she did not coin that phrase. I heard that phrase before, probably she was even born.
Mm-hmm.
Then my psychological problem is that, like, well, then I have to pretend that you did for until I die.
Until the end of time. Yeah. Well, so, I'll remain on board.
Yep. All right. Good. Got a lot to get to today, folks. So let's jump right in. You know, it's interesting. We have another clip, like the one we played yesterday, where Sean Hannity is pressing his guests to essentially say what DeSantis did was illegal. And I think that's Hannity's really ham-fisted and inept way of championing Donald Trump. But nevertheless...
Yeah. Donald Trump, who didn't comment on it either. He was given a chance to comment on it, and he started talking about the border broadly.
Well, he was pissed because Donald Trump knows our history and knows that this is what was done with slaves back in the...
it's like the reverse freedom rides.
Antebellum era, and doesn't like Ron DeSantis taking his shtick. But the interesting thing is that I don't think that DeSantis really contemplated that anybody was going to look into this. There is a lawsuit that's being filed, the class action lawsuit, based on, against you file these civil cases based upon existing statute. But there are other questions, and they are mounting, and he doesn't seem to have a good answer for them. Here is Ron DeSantis. I don't even know how to characterize this answer with a very, very incoherent, weak T answer as to why did you basically find these Venezuelan immigrants, not illegal, incidentally, we'll go over that again after this clip, in Texas and fly them to Florida to make your point that you don't want them in Florida. All right, pause it. Hold on for one second. I should just say, if you can't hear that, the questioner was asking that it's been confirmed that Florida is spending $1 million in taxpayer dollars to fly a plane, I think she said, from Texas again to Delaware. Ostensibly, they want to do this stunt in front of Joe Biden's house because this is what DeSantis thinks the tax dollars are meant to do these I own the lib stunts. And frankly, I mean, for these immigrants, it's like they're winning the lottery because they're actually getting more care in these states as opposed to what you would see, like, let's say, I guess, in Florida. But here he is answering that.
From that, I can't. Well, we do both. So we've had interdiction in the panhandle. The problem is we're not seeing mass movements of them into Florida. So you end up with a car with maybe two. And if we know that that's illegal and there's someone that's kind of smuggling, then committing crime, then you can do arrest. There have been drug seizures. But that's not effective enough to stop the mass migration, but it's just coming in onesie-twosies. So we've had people on the border for last summer. We've done a lot of intelligence, and everyone down there will say between a third and 40% of the people coming across are seeking to end up in Florida. And so we have to go and figure out, okay, who are those people likely to be? And if you can do it at the source and divert to sanctuary jurisdictions, the chance they end up in Florida is much less. And the thing is, with the sanctuary, that the idea is...
All right, pause it. Let me just, like, interpret what he... Well, I didn't interpret. He's asked, why did you have to find immigrants in Texas? Now, let's also be clear. These are asylum seekers. They are not illegal. The law in the United States says when those refugee seekers step on U.S. territory and turn themselves in, They are now in the legal process. They may not be citizens, but they are legal here in the same way, or a slightly different way, but broadly speaking, in the same way that, like, someone flies over from, I don't know, some country in Asia or Middle East or Europe, flies here. They're not citizens, but they're legal. They're legal. They're within a process. They have to leave after a certain period of time. There are certain things that they need to, deal with. These people are legal. They have court dates. He's arguing that they have people on the ground in Texas. And it's unclear whether these are state employees, whether they are contracted out, but they're gathering intel on so-called illegals who are migrating to Florida.
Onesie twosies.
In onesies twosies.
Meaning, like, they're just mini caravans, right? Not, no longer caravans of migrants. It's just people arriving in cars. So mini caravans, of course.
30 to 40%, he says, of all the people across the border are coming into Florida in twosies and onesies.
Onesie twosies.
And he is now claiming that what they do is interdict there and then send them to sanctuary states, which is, if those 50 Venezuelan refugees constitute even anything close to 30 or 40% of people who come across the border, then we don't have... I don't understand what the issue is. You're saying, like,
yeah, what is the issue if they're going to these sanctuary cities? This is the exact nature of the stunt that you pulled off, which is like, wouldn't you like it if they came to your area? But you're saying that that's already happening.
Well, he's claiming that they have some type of major operation that is somehow stopping these people before they get, like, a pre-crime in his mind, before they get to Florida, and sending them other places, which, of course, is demonstrably untrue. So he is really trying hard here not to answer the question, who was on the ground, who was paying for them on the ground, how long have they been there, why are they there, and why did you pull this stunt this way? You can't find any refugees in Florida. You can't find any asylum seekers in Florida. You can't find any undocumented immigrants in Florida. I don't understand what the problem is. Oh, he only comes in onesies and twosies. All right, but continue.
Because they have more benefits or whatever they do, that people will be able to stick. And so that's why you're doing it. If I could do it all in Florida, I would. But if we just ignore the source, then you're going to have people trickling in, 5, 10 a day, 20 a day. I don't know. But there's no way you can possibly track all of that because it's on such a small scale. Whereas if you know there's maybe 1,000 people down there and a lot of them say in Florida, well, you could say, well, hey, wait a minute. Here's a sanctuary jurisdiction. Be able to provide the transport. So if that's what you want to do, you do. And I think that that's much more effective than just trying to send one or two out at a time. Also point out, you know, we have a whole infrastructure in place now because of what the legislature did. So it's not just flights. You know, we had ground. We have other things that we can do. And I'll tell you this, it's already made more of an impact than anyone thought it could possibly make. But we're going to continue to make more of an impact. And I think that at the end of the day, what we're doing is not the ultimate solution. I think it's opening people's eyes to the solution, which is, let's have a secure border. Let's have remain in Mexico. Let's take the cartels seriously, and let's get with the program.
All right, I don't want to hear it. Okay, so he's arguing that there's already a significant infrastructure that Florida has in Texas that is shipping these people by, it sounds like, by car and truck and plane and who knows, maybe rail, to sanctuary states. And I would be curious as to what the data is on, like, how effective this program has been.
I'd be curious, too, about where that funding is coming from. He has evaded that question as well. Is this coming from the taxpayers in Florida that are paying for these secret ops and agents that are roaming around Texas who are putting migrants into sanctuary cities?
If it's already making a big difference in Florida, I mean, we got to be talking about thousands, tens of thousands, right? I mean, how many, like, why isn't he bragging about this? What an amazing, innovative program. I wonder if Glenn Abbott has signed off on this, too. Does Texas allow there to be, like, a mini Florida operation going on there? This is all bullshit. And I think the thing that he's having a problem with is he's starting to realize, like, maybe some of this press is not going to let go of this.
He doesn't have the stuff. Like, I'm becoming increasingly convinced that this guy is in over his head in terms of just trying to go to the next thing that's going to be a stunt that appeals to the Republican primary voter. And he's burning out quickly. Like, when he is met with the smallest amount of scrutiny, he folds. So I don't know. He should be a little bit worried about his primary chances.
Kilgore Trout on Twitter has a funny tweet. My plan to own the libs by dropping my kidnapped victims off on Cutthroat Lawyer Island is going exactly as planned.
Exactly. We should say, like, multiple people have already IM'd us about his use of the ultimate solution for immigrants. That's an interesting turn of phrase. I wonder.
Does he mean granting them amnesty en masse in the state of Florida because it works out for me politically? Oh, wait.
Ultimate solution is like the last solution. It's almost like the final solution. I'm sure it's just a, but again, reminder, these people are asylum seekers. They are legal. They are legal. I mean, I don't think you refer to anybody as being legal in, you know, when seniors buy drugs in Canada because it's cheaper, we don't refer to them as illegal seniors because they did something that was when people speed, get a ticket, I don't refer to them as illegal drivers. But these folks are well within their rights. And are trying to do the right thing by going to their court cases. And, of course, DeSantis somehow, his Operation Florida in Texas interdiction has successful, at least for these 50 people. All right. Do we need to take a quick break? We do. Okay. Just a reminder, folks, this program relies on you for its very existence. You can help this show survive and thrive by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half free of commercials too. And the fun half. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Just Coffee is a movement partner. Great co-op. They're very, very helpful to their suppliers, farms in Mexico and in Africa. So check them out. And you can buy the Majority Report blend. There's other blends you can get, too, that I enjoy. But the Majority Report blend is always a staple. Definitely want to get that one. All right, quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Jonah Furman. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program somebody who I've been reading for quite a while. I follow you on Twitter as well. Jonah Furman of Labor Notes. He's the author of Who Gets the Bird, a newsletter on Substack. If you want a sense of what's going on in terms of the labor movement in this country, at the moment, Jonah's Twitter feed is a great place to start. Anyways, Jonah, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So will you just back up a little bit for us in terms of what's happened with this labor strike? There was a little bit of a blip, I guess, like 45 days ago or so, where it hit the news in a sort of mainstream way, and then it punted for 30 days. Just give us some background as to how we got to where we are today, you know, maybe up to how we got to where we are last Thursday on the railway strike.
Sure. Yeah. So what people should understand is that in this country, because of strikes in the 19th century, railroads are covered under different law, which uses the federal government a lot more. So there's all these different points where they'll be like, OK, 30 day cooling off, kick it to the federal government, advisory board, mediators, all these things. So these negotiations actually are from 2019. The contract we're talking about is a 2019 contract that has been delayed 3 years. Now, the whole process involves, you know, bringing in mediators, bringing in recommendations. And the thing you're talking about 45 days ago in August was the Presidential Emergency Board. So this is pretty rare in rail negotiations. Usually they'll have a deal before it gets to this level. But there's part of the rail negotiations involved the president appointing a board of mediators to say, here's what we think the deal should be. You guys, the unions and the railroad companies can't agree. Here's what it should be. So that report came out, and that's where you saw this basically proposed settlement that said you're going to get money, but you're not going to get more time off, is essentially the trade-off that was made. You're going to get 24% raises, but you're not going to get any additional time off the job. Now, that turns into a vote among unions saying, okay, do you like that deal? Do you want to turn that into an actual contract? That's the strong recommendation of the government, but what do the workers think? And essentially last week what we saw is workers taking up that deal across 13 different unions. There was a little bit of difference in different types of workers, what they thought of it. But you saw two of the unions reject it. Two of the unions say, we're not even going to consider this a contract. And we got within hours of what would have been a national rail shutdown. There's more details to it, but essentially what happened last Thursday is...
All right, well, hold on. Let's stop. Sure. I want to stop there.
Yeah.
A couple of things to talk about. So we're talking about the Railway Labor Act. What other... And obviously, I think people can imagine when you're talking about the 1800s, railways are central to the functioning of the country. So we understand maybe why there would be special laws passed to deal in a not leave it up to, you know, essentially the free market, I guess, to resolve these things. What other are there other specific sort of like silos of labor in this country that are subject to their own labor acts in some way where the government has this type of like mediative role?
It's pretty unique. I mean, the Railway Labor Act is from before any other labor law in this country because it was such a big deal. 1877, there was huge strikes that they basically sent in the army to run the railroads. There was like, you know, shootouts, things like that. For about 50 years, there was this level of unrest. So in the 20s, they do the Railway Labor Act. That only covers railroad workers and some airline workers. Other than that, like in the private sector, everybody else got their own set aside law that we're more familiar with under the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. And then, of course, in the public sector, you have more government involvement because, you know, you have your bargaining with the state government.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And those are all a patchwork. But aside from federal workers, there's no other case in which, certainly not in the private sector, where the federal government has like a stated expected role directly in negotiations on the level of like, here's the provisions we would recommend.
Okay, and so the Presidential Emergency Board, during that 30-day cooling down period, comes up with this deal. When you say time off, we're really talking about, like, it's not, you know, we want a six-week vacation in August. It's, I'm sick. My kid's sick. My mom or dad is sick. My significant other is sick. And if I go to the doctor, I get docked pay, which you would presume, like, well, we want our workers to be able to be in good health and not to get other people sick. But that's not the way it worked. Right. So could you get like drill down into that dynamic a little bit so that we really get a sense of that?
is actually worse than what you said. It's not that you get docked pay. That's where the negotiations went, is can we just get docked pay? You get docked on your attendance policy, which means you're one step closer to getting fired, and you need to work continuous hours to get those points, as they call them, off of your attendance policy. In February, there was almost a strike on one of the rail lines because they instituted a new, even worse attendance policy that basically says if you miss a day, you have to work something like 6 weeks straight without missing a day. And when we talk about time off, so there's the sick leave, that's one thing. But rail workers are on call unless they're not. So when rail workers say they have 30 days off in the year, which is the number, we're about that for most of these workers, 30 days off during the year, they're counting as if weekends, you know, that's their weekends too. So everyone else has 2 days out of every week. So that's 104 days off a year. These workers have 30. And one other per month. So it depends exactly, but they don't have a 5 day work.
I didn't know that.
Yes, they sit next to their phone and they say, I could get called in for a 3 day trip within 2 hours. You know, the exact rules change. And if I miss a phone call, or if I'm at a wedding or a funeral or the birth of my child, and it wasn't scheduled for this XYZ day, suddenly you're talking about getting fired. So you're not just talking about if I don't go, I can't afford it, it's a hardship. That's where that's where they got in the negotiations, is can we at least do that? Where if I miss a day for sickness or something like this, I at least don't get disciplined. But they actually are getting, you know, disciplined and fired for taking time off for routine things like that.
So it's impossible to schedule anything in your life or be able to say, I've got a wedding, I've got a funeral, I've got something that most people take for granted that they can't miss or they don't want to miss. And it's not even a question of like, I can't afford to miss work that day. It's I'm just not allowed to do it and keep my job.
Yeah, yeah. It's more like I'm 25 years into this job and I'm committed and I have to, this is my career and my livelihood, and I'm risking it all if something comes up. And one other wrinkle to it that people should appreciate is that one of the reasons it's coming to a head right now, it's been like this on the railroads for a long time, but in the past 5 to 10 years, they've started this new system, basically, it's called precision scheduled railroading, but it's a new management regime that part of it is, I mean, it's just like a lot of other industries with just-in-time production and lean manufacturing, things like that, that are doing more with less. But literally in the past 6 years, they've cut something like 30% of the workforce on these railroads. Wow. So you can imagine what that does for scheduling. If you're on call all the time and there's nobody else to cover, suddenly this is why they need more draconian attendance policies, because they've cut everybody out.
Plus, is there 30% less rail activity?
There's much more, right? I mean, the pandemic, we know from people being home, things are getting shipped more than people going out. You know, just like we saw parcel delivery go way up at Amazon and UPS, that's all the supply chain. So all the stresses on the supply chain is totally separate from this huge explicit cut in the workforce. You know, one of the big fights is they're trying to go to one-man crews, which basically means you're driving a train that is like 3 miles long. And currently you have to have 2 people on that train at least. So, you know, if someone, God forbid, passes out, there's someone still driving this extremely dangerous vehicle. They've been trying for years to go to one-man crews just because they want to cut half the people they have to pay, regardless of how inefficient that is, dangerous that is, you know, just like unthinkable that you would have just one guy driving a 4-mile train that can kill people and does. I mean, one thing people didn't appreciate is that last week during the negotiations, 2 rail workers were killed in a derailment. Like, this is people's lives. It's not like, you know, it's the unpaid sick days is sort of become like this this highlight, the flagship thing. But this is a dangerous job with workers getting ground down, and not just the pandemic, but this whole management regime of the past 5 to 10 years.
And in terms of just like record profits for the rail carriers, so they're cutting the workforce to get lean and mean, and putting that on the backs of workers. But they've made a ton of money over the past during that period, right?
Yeah, and huge. I mean, just like we've seen a lot of corporate America, huge stock buybacks. Warren Buffett is one of the owners of BNSF, one of the big railroads involved here. And another thing people should appreciate about sort of the profit margins here is that the railroads that we're talking about are functionally monopolies. there are six carriers we're talking about, but they don't overlap geographically. So BNSF is not competing with Union Pacific. They have different rail lines, and the companies they serve can't just switch to trucks and boats and planes. It's not economical, and you can't just set up a new railroad next to the existing one. So there's no competition here for these companies to stay efficient. So they decided we don't really need to be efficient because we have a huge captive chunk of the economy and businesses that need our rails. And we can just save money by cutting workers. And who's going to stop us? Literally, the only person who's going to stop them is the workers. And that's what last week and this ongoing fight is about.
When did all of these railways, these rail lines, they're for the most part privately owned. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So we have this dynamic here, and it takes us to last Thursday, where the unions are brought in. I've read the reporting, Marty Walsh up until 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning, or I don't know, got 15 minutes of sleep, negotiates this deal essentially to get buy-in by the two reluctant unions that are holding out for some form of really just respect of their humanity. I mean, it seems like. The union leadership signs off on it at least enough so that it can enter into another cooling off period. Is that what happens? And then, so take it from there and walk us through what happens next.
Yeah, exactly. People might have seen this term tentative agreement. This is like a union term. It basically means you have a deal between the bargaining committees involved. So the company and then the union's representatives have said, here's a deal that we think is decent enough to go to a ratification. Ratification is where you send it out to all the members and it gets voted up or down. In this case, we're talking about 13 different unions. So it is one sort of negotiation. It's all lined up time-wise, but it really is 13 separate contracts with 13 unions whose memberships have to vote 51% that we want to take this deal and get back to work. So signing the tentative agreement under this Railway Labor Act kicks the cooling off period a certain amount of time. And we actually don't know. It has not been made fully public what the date is of the next cooling off period, but we're just back where we were a month ago. The funny thing about seeing people say it's over. There's a vote here. They could easily vote it down. One union did last week, voted down the agreement. Two unions actually voted down the agreement last week. So they could easily vote it down and we get to the next cooling off period and suddenly we're at a standoff again. I think there's reasons they wanted to kick it, but this thing is very much even not even like you hope the workers will hold out for more, nothing like that. It's just literally the process has not come to its end. And there's a lot of reasons to think that at least one of these 13 unions is going to vote no and hit their deadline. And then who knows what the next settlement is.
I mean, they wanted to punt this to the other side of the election. I mean, that was the primary. What is the leverage that the U.S. has, the federal government has in terms of the railway operators? In other words, it seems to me like I could make a pretty strong case. I don't know, nobody's asking me to, but we sort of need those railways. Eminent domain, it seems to me a pretty good argument that we need those railways, particularly if we're going to upgrade our rail system in this country. We haven't quite gotten there yet, but, you know, no better time than the present. Is that something Marty Walsh could say, like, here's Pete Buttigieg. I know this is fantastical based upon on who we're talking about. But theoretically, couldn't somebody in the room say, like, Jesus, maybe what we just need to do is eminent domain and get these railway lines and start charging you guys a fee for running on these lines, because this is national security. I mean, there's a reason why we have a Railway Labor Act and we don't have a, you know, Chuck E. Cheese Labor Act or something.
Yes, and there's also a reason why the federal government owns the U.S. Postal Service and doesn't let Warren Buffett own it. You know, I think that's totally right. And if you look at other countries, really far short of radical governments have maintained that rail lines just fall under this national security, national interest thing. That should totally be on the table. I will say there's other options the federal government has here. So under the Rail Labor Act, it's expected that if we get to a strike or a work stoppage, Congress is, unlike in almost any other union negotiation, is empowered to step in and say, you're going back to work. The lockout is over. The strike is over. And here are the terms under which you're going back. Now, last week, we saw the GOP put forward this bill saying, you're going back under the presidential emergency board deal, which they know the workers can't live with. But they love it because it's Joe Biden's deal and they're the GOP. So they get to say, Joe Biden said this is your deal. Now, there's no reason Congress, you saw Bernie, he stood up and basically filibustered that bill getting passed and said, these workers need paid sick day, their health care is unaffordable, various issues they have. There's no reason Congress couldn't have a bill that says, okay, if there's a lockout, the workers are going back with, you know, free health care, with paid sick days, with cost of living adjustments. That's totally doable legally, structurally. It would be totally in line with what we understand the Railway Labor Act to be about, which Congress intervenes at the end. So the fact that nobody's talked about that or talked about, like you're saying, you know, at least some receivership, trusteeship over these companies that seriously cannot seem to run a rail line. I mean, you look at freight shipment times, look at the supply chain. It's not just manufacturing. It's also distribution. You cut all your workers, you can't get stuff there on time. So these options are politically on the table. They're not really that fantastical, but there has not been a lot of champions out there saying, let's try it.
Have you heard anything from anybody out of maybe Sanders' office or somebody else that is like prepping a bill like this? Because from reading your reporting, there seems to be at least some sentiment amongst some of the workers and the union folk that we should kick this to Congress. I mean, if they do that, let's say during the lame duck period, when the Democrats, if there's a strike, let's say, I don't know, 3 weeks before Christmas, when everybody's waiting for their presents to show up, there's a bill offered by Democrats to do a lot of what you say, and Republicans are the ones standing in front of it and blocking everybody from getting their Christmas presents because they don't want workers to be able to go to a funeral or take care of their sick kids. To me, that sounds like a fairly good situation to be in politically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the extent of what we've seen is Bernie Sanders put out a statement saying, whatever the rail workers decide, I'll have their back. And that has some credibility for the way that he stopped, you know, from insider reports, it seems like his intervention really did stop them from imposing that deal. A lot of what you're talking about is sort of who gets the blame for a stoppage and who's going to, you know, whose side will Congress intervene on, if anything. I think if you talk to rail workers, you know, their hope was not that Congress is going to have a bill that fixes all their problems or nationalize the railroads or fix all these issues. But they were hoping at least, if nothing else, Congress would stay out of it and let the railroads feel the economic pain. You know, they talk a lot about the harm it would do to the U.S. economy, and that's true. But it would also do a lot of harm to Warren Buffett and the people who own these companies if there was a strike. Traditionally, that's how a strike works, right? The workers shut it down. The owners feel economic pain and feel like they have to come back to the table with something more meaningful. So, you know, I think the lowest bar is people in Congress saying, we're not going to intervene. We're not going to help the railroad companies get out of this with a deal that they prefer. And the higher bar is saying, why not have legislation saying paid sick days for railroad workers? Why not have legislation saying cost of living adjustments for anyone in the supply chain? You know, however you want to slice it, there's certain baseline demands here that are clearly in the national interest. We just haven't seen people come out and champion it. And meanwhile, the union leadership, you know, they're in a position where they're trying to pass a ratification vote. So there's not one union leader you can go to and say, what would you really, really like? They're trying to get through this crisis moment themselves too. So it's really the rank and file members who I've heard have been calling their congresspeople saying, can you do a cost of living adjustment bill? Can you do a free health care bill for rail workers? Can you do even just 5 paid sick days? You know, but there's really a question of who's going to step up and be courageous enough to say, we are intervening. We're intervening for the workers. You know, it's supposed to be the Democratic Party is the working class party, you know, so this would be a great way to show it.
All right. One more quick question. Or I guess maybe this is a two-parter. What is the strength of, and I know there's 12 unions, so maybe there's not one answer for this. But in terms of like strike funds, in terms of solidarity, in terms of all the assets you would need to enter into a, you know, I don't think would be a prolonged strike because there's so much money being lost by these railway barons, essentially. But how, you know, how are the assets in terms of the durability of that solidarity and the their capacity to stay out on strike in terms of these unions? Again, I know there's 12 unions, so it might be hard to make a blanket assessment. And also relative the relationship between the rank and file and the leadership. You know, give me a sense of or give us a sense of that, I guess.
Yeah, well, on the, you know, on strike funds and things like that, I don't think there's a universe in which this is a long strike. I think these workers, you know, you can look at 92, 91 is the last time we had any rail disruptions. We're talking about less than a few days until Congress says this has to end under a better deal. So I don't think people are, you know, concerned with a long strike fund. There is a lot of, you know, despite the division, there's some inspiring shows of solidarity among these workers. So, you know, you had one union that had a deal set and said, well, if the other union doesn't get it, we're not going to cross the picket line. We're not going to work. Something you should also understand is that, you know, in 92, the last time there was a shutdown, it was one union on one rail line that struck, which shut down the whole system because it's all interconnected operationally. So, you know, I do think there's an opening here for even if one of the smaller unions, you know, 5,000 members, they have, you know, say half the people vote and 1,500 of them vote no. We're looking at a serious, you know, there's the math here is pretty easy for this deal not to go through. It's harder to see how it does get ratified. And you know, looking at where workers were at before the Marty Walsh deal, before the unpaid sick time and the small tweaks they made, you had internal polls from some of these unions saying 80% of the members were ready to vote no, 90% wanted to strike. So the question, when I look at it, I'm just thinking, do these tweaks, some unpaid sick time that's really unclear, does that really move it 20, 30 points on the vote? Nice. It's hard to imagine. And at this point, a lot of workers I talk to are just saying, look, it's been 3 years of buildup on this. It's been 20 years of working this job. This was our moment. And I'm not ready to say we got everything that we can right now. It reminds me of talking to people at John Deere last year and other strikes where they repeatedly vote down agreements because they feel this is sort of their one shot. And if they sign a deal, it's 5 years until the next contract expiration is up. Who knows what conditions will be like.
And who knows who the administration will be at that time, too. You might lose some leverage there. Like you say, we don't know how long the cooling off period is. My bet is it's past November 8th, but probably not much past November 8th. So I suspect we're going to want to talk to you again relatively soon. In the meantime, folks should check out your Twitter feed and labor notes and your Substack, Who Gets the Bird. Thank you so much, Yonefram. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Emma is going to interview Seth Harp, investigative reporter and contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, about his piece on the problem with overdoses at Fort Bragg. I'm going to go off and deal with the sick child stuff, but I will be back after that interview, and just got to make a couple phone calls and make sure that no one has burned down any places.
Okay, good.
We'll be right back after this.
We are back, and we are joined now by Seth Harp, investigative reporter and contributing editor at Rolling Stone, whose piece on Fort Bragg is like really just a must-read for everybody. Seth, thanks so much for being here today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you begin your piece kind of setting the scene of two men who were killed by gunshots outside of Fort Bragg. And the numbers are just startling in terms of how many deaths have piled up since the beginning of 2020. What led you to looking into this, and take us to the beginning of your piece where you initially set that scene?
Yeah, it was that double murder that you just referred to that initially brought me to the story of Fort Bragg, the larger story of Fort Bragg. The murder of Billy Levine and Timothy Dumas. That actually happened in December 2020. Last time I came on y'all's show, I talked a bit about that and some other murders that seem to be linked to drug trafficking by elite soldiers at Fort Bragg. And at that time, I mentioned that there had been a large number of deaths of Fort Bragg soldiers in general. So aside from the murders, there have been at least 44 deaths at Fort Bragg among soldiers that year in 2020. And I told you all about how I was trying to figure out exactly what was going on there, what was behind such a high body count. Now, come to find out here almost a full year later with the latest piece, the total number of soldiers that have died at Fort Bragg over two-year time period from 2020 to 2021 was 109. 105 of those occurred stateside, whereas only four of them took place in overseas combat operations. And the latest piece I wrote for Rolling Stone really focuses on one of the major leading causes of death there, which is accidental drug overdoses, which is pretty obviously linked to the prior topic, which was a lot of the drug crime that's going on in Fort Bragg.
Set the stage, too, for just what Fort Bragg is for our audience in terms of, like, its role in some of the special ops bureaucracy and just how, essentially, there's a lot of, like, elite military training that happens there, and with that comes a ton of secrecy, which I'm sure was a major obstacle in your reporting on this. So for our audience, what is Fort Bragg and what goes on there in terms of training?
Yeah, totally. I described it in the piece as the beating heart of the U.S. global special operations complex. Fort Bragg is not just any army base. It's the Army's most important installation, probably the most important military installation in the United States. It's the home of the Airborne Corps, the Green Berets, Special Forces, and also JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command. Which is a covert military within the military that since 9/11 has become by far the most powerful combatant command in the entire Pentagon, has enormous autonomy and global reach and power. It's based there at Fort Bragg. That's where its headquarters is. It's a compound within the compound there. And I'm not sure that most people who are unfamiliar with these issues are really aware of the transformation of the military over the last 20 years, over this component of the military, into something more like an intelligence agency than what we would think of as a traditional Army Special Forces unit that really is just, hitters that follow orders that go out and, kick down doors and raid compounds. That JSOC does a lot more than that. I was just talking to a source yesterday who was a civilian employee for Delta Force, which is the Army component of JSOC. She was talking about her job was to create cover identities for operators in Delta Force. So she would make, fake license plates, fake driver's licenses, and get fake passports. Of course, not fake, they're all real. They're actually issued by these agencies, by these offices of the United States or states. So they're official documents, but they, they're fictitious. And they would use these documents to do missions that are totally covert. So you're not talking about guys wearing uniforms and carrying guns. This person that I spoke to yesterday mentioned operations in China and in Israel in particular. So that's just to name two examples of countries where you have undercover, active duty U.S. military members going and doing intelligence collections operations covertly, without the knowledge of those countries, China or Israel, and of course without the knowledge of the U.S. public. So that's the kind of thing that goes on at Fort Bragg, which makes the endemic drug crime there all the more alarming, I think.
And also just lacking in terms of any oversight, not just from the outside, from reporting, but the budget is classified, which I was not aware of, and it's expensive to train these officers there and these soldiers there, and yet there's quite very little sunlight on what happens, and so it makes the deaths and the clear homicides impossible to really kind of get to the bottom of, but also this burgeoning drug crime that you've done reporting on.
Yeah, we American citizens not authorized to know how much JSOC cost us, also not authorized to know what countries JSOC is operating in, whether they're doing covert wars in countries like the Philippines or Mali or Somalia, Yemen. We're not authorized to know anything about that, so don't ask. That's the U.S. government position, and if that's news to you, you should probably get in a time machine and go back to about 2001, because this has been going on for all of these years, kind of underneath the radar.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, when you think about like post 9/11 special ops, it probably all originates, or much of it originates from here. So I want to get into the drug overdose piece, but just to set the stage a little bit more for why there were so many deaths. Your initial reporting on this spoke about not just homicides or killings, beheadings that were kind of swept under the rug, but this was all within the context of a large drug usage kind of ring, trafficking ring that was already in existence, and there was a lot of intense drug use, wide drug use under a lot of secrecy at Fort Bragg. So talk about that.
Yeah, all of those things. You know, to be clear, I'm not alleging like a dark alliance type thing where the U.S. Army Special Forces is trafficking cocaine from Colombia or wherever to the United States. I don't think that's happening. I don't see why that would be happening, because they have all the money that they could possibly want. So why would they need to engage in that kind of thing? But I do think that it's more and more the kind of thing that various Green Berets, also Navy SEALs, have been getting into more and more over the past 5 years or so. I said, I think it's really not my opinion. There's been at least a half dozen cases of current or former Green Berets or Navy SEALs who have not just been charged with, but actually either convicted or pleaded guilty to heavy duty trafficking charges since about 2015. And there are cases where they never got to anywhere near a courtroom, like the case of Billy Levine, who was found shot to death outside of Fort Bragg. Also, Timothy Dumas. We'll never figure out exactly what they were up to. The other beheading case you mentioned of Enrique Roman Martinez, I recently acquired CID's investigative file into that, which makes it clear, as my initial reporting suggested or strongly implied, whatever happened, it had something to do with those soldiers' distribution of LSD in Fort Bragg, some kind of dispute over their LSD distribution activities there. So this kind of thing really pervades Fort Bragg by the base's own admission. Drug crime was up 100% in 2021 or 2020. And to me, it's very indicative of a kind of institutional breakdown, breakdown in good order and discipline at Fort Bragg after 20 years of forever war, in which the Fort Bragg units have been the ones that have been deployed over and over to Afghanistan, over and over to Iraq. It's always the 82nd Airborne that the president goes to, if not, the 5th Group or the 7th Group or JSOC. It's one of these formations inevitably. Most recently, the evacuation of the Kabul airport was done by the 82nd. Last soldier to die in Afghanistan was a member of the 82nd. And once again, they were deployed when the war in Ukraine started to backstop NATO forces over there in Poland. 5,000 Fort Bragg soldiers from the 82nd went over there. That's all to say nothing of what the Green Berets continue to do in countries like Iraq, Syria, and of course what JSOC is doing, which we don't get to know because it's all classified. So I see it all as part of the same phenomenon. Drugs allow soldiers and operators to work longer hours, with less sleep, with less food. It's also very, you know, people turn to drugs. People who have been traumatized, whether it's from killing other human beings or seeing people killed, often will turn to drugs to mediate the auto-medicate the intense anxiety and depression that is associated with PTSD. So it's all part of the same really ugly and unfortunate picture, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, it's the cycle of trauma. And the reality is that if there is more sunlight on what's happening at Fort Bragg or what that money is going towards, then there's going to be larger understanding that, like, actually we are inflicting immense trauma on our own soldiers through these forever wars and through these programs. That, I mean, the numbers are staggering in terms of these fentanyl overdoses and deaths as a result of drugs. Just talk about the people that you spoke with and what they've said about how their family and friends have turned to drugs just to deal with the trauma that they've endured over the past, I don't know, how many decades of service? 2 decades.
Well, it's worth splitting up, you know, 2 groups of types of soldiers in this context. And the first is kind of what we're talking about before. Guys in their 30s or even their 40s who are operators who are Green Berets who have done many deployments, sometimes over a dozen deployments. A lot of those guys also use drugs, not just for mediating trauma, but because in the Army, because so many resources and privileges have been heaped on the special forces and the special operations over the last few decades, that, you know, they kind of live like rock star lifestyles in places like Fayetteville, which is the big military town right by Fort Bragg. There's a ton of partying going on. Soldiers like to drink. That's hardly groundbreaking news. But the use of cocaine in particular as just as a party drug or something that folks take when they're drinking, that's really on the rise in special operations and kind of low-key that most folks are not culturally attuned to. But it's also the same thing in the Navy SEALs. Lots of reports over the last few years of SEALs doing hard drugs. Not just, you know, we're not talking about guys drinking beer and smoking weed, we're talking about heroin, crack cocaine, MDMA, those kind of things using on a regular basis. So that's one component of it. And another component of it that I reported on is a bit different. We're talking about the 82nd Airborne, which is conventional Army, although it's airborne, it's conventional Army. So you have a lot of young soldiers who are 18, 19, 20 years old. And what I've reported on going on with that population is a lot of fentanyl overdoses. And to answer your question, you know, I've interviewed family members of soldiers who have died at Fort Bragg from fentanyl overdoses, many of whom say that their son, it's usually their son, in some cases their brother, had no history of drug use at all, and was dead within a year of being stationed at Fort Bragg. So some questions when I hear cases like that, which include, by the way, talking about the case of Matthew Disney, talking about the case of Joshua Diamond, Zachary Bracken, just to name a few of young soldiers who have died and whose families have interviewed. And they say that, you know, that none of those men had any history of drug use before they got to Fort Bragg. So what I like to know is, one, where did they get the fentanyl that killed them? You know, did they get it from another soldier? And also, you know, was this something that they were doing before they got to Fort Bragg? Because, you know, or was it something that developed afterwards? Because they're literally in the custody of the U.S. government and were owed some kind of answer when people who are active duty soldiers die. And so far, we haven't gotten anything remotely like some kind of answer, even a response from the Army.
What's the relationship between local law enforcement in Fayetteville and how their ability to investigate any of the potential crimes coming out of Fort Bragg, which is like in their backyard, but I'd imagine they get bigfooted quite a lot.
Yeah. I mean, what's the role of local law enforcement there to cover up crimes? I don't know. They don't solve a lot of them. That's for sure. I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush. Sometimes they carry out busts. They busted a master sergeant in the 82nd named Martin Acevedo III, heavy-duty cocaine trafficking charges, caught him with a bunch of firearms, coke, and cash at his house. So you do see busts like that. However, in a lot of other cases, it's very clear that, especially when the soldier concerned is the member of an elite unit and they could potentially embarrass an organization like JSOC or the First Special Forces Command, those charges just disappear. I mean, you don't see in Cumberland County, Hope County, all the other counties around Fort Bragg, you will not see a Delta Force operator come up on charges. It doesn't matter what he did. It doesn't matter if he rammed his car while he was driving drunk into a bunch of teenagers and fled on foot, like a Delta operator named Lee Vampola did earlier this year. Those charges, don't know what happened to those. All this is allegedly, by the way, because it's just an arrest report that I'm going off of. But those charges just went away. You know, Billy Levine committed a string of crimes around, allegedly committed a string of crimes around Fayetteville. Five separate felonies he was arrested for, including aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and murder, first degree murder. He was arrested for that. All those charges disappear. Cristobal Lopez Vallejo, arrested for second degree rape. He's another Delta operator. All these guys I mentioned are Delta operators. Once again, those charges ultimately disappeared from the Cumberland County criminal docket. So I don't think you can ever see a case where you're going to find a man who served in Delta Force as an operator ends up in a courtroom and being actually prosecuted. I've never seen a case like that.
I mean, did they not collect any evidence in some of these cases? It seems like so clear, right? And your piece from 2021, this was a homicide, and yet it seems like there was not any testimony taken, any physical evidence collected. I mean, how is that even possible?
I don't know what the tenor of the conversations were that took place behind closed doors, but I don't think you would see the same thing if it was just a regular Joe who was drunk and high, you know, out of his mind on four different substances, shoots and kills a guy, his best friend, for no apparent reason with his personal firearm, comes up with this cockamamie story about how his buddy came at him with a screwdriver and he had to do it with self-defense. And that's all that was good enough for the detectives in Cumberland County. That was good enough for Billy West, who's the DA of Cumberland County. Charges were dismissed that same night. Billy Levine was never even drug tested. And as the sister of that victim in that homicide told me, if they had done a proper investigation, all the bodies and drugs that were associated with Levine could have been avoided.
It just really is just jarring. And to zoom out a little bit, the stories that come out of Fort Bragg really do seem to be, it's almost our war on terror in a nutshell, right? Where a complete lack of oversight for special operations, funding that is endless and seems to just like be unencumbered by any stories of brutality or murder or cruelty that come out of these places. And yet, you know, it seems that the president has the authority, if he wanted to, if this reporting was more highlighted, to alter that. But like, once these systems of shadowy power are created, it's like they just they're unencumbered, and it's really difficult for there to be any outside pressure to end them because they become organisms onto themselves.
I couldn't agree more. It's not clear who's exercising oversight over JSOC now. I mean, when it first was exponentially increased to have enormous power and funding and global reach under the Bush administration, and then later even to an even greater extent under the Obama administration, I think they were actively utilizing the unit in all kinds of different ways and knew more or less what kind of operations were going on. But they cut the regular military chain of command out of they cut the regular Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of Defense out of the chain of command. So JSOC effectively answers directly to the president. And that's constitutionally problematic in a lot of ways. That ship, of course, has sailed. We just live in a country now where the president has his own personal covert military to call on. But to what extent the Biden administration is actually exercising oversight over JSOC, that's a good question. I don't really have any insight into that. Honestly, to me, they seem pretty checked out, and who knows what's going on behind the scenes. What I know, what I report on is weird stuff that happens around Fort Bragg where it's never fully explained, but just seems highly suggestive and suspicious, for lack of a better word. I mean, just less than a month ago, or perhaps a month ago, a contract pilot for Delta Force named Charles Crooks fell out of a plane into someone's suburban backyard in Fayetteville. Just a dead body fell out, or a man's body fell out of the sky, hit their backyard, and he died. Now, he was a contract pilot, a civilian contract pilot for USAFOC, which is the U.S. Army Special Operations Command, probably for Delta Force. And there's no clear explanation of how he fell or jumped, is the language that you'll see in reporting around this at all. And the official story, or the story that authorities seem to be going with, at least initially, is that he mid-flight became upset over something, felt sick and needed some fresh air. To me, that is not a very satisfactory explanation at all. And you know, just a few years before this, another Delta Force contract pilot, a man named Tim Thacker, was arrested and sentenced to 40 years in prison for trafficking methamphetamine in North Carolina. The Justice Department describes him as a major methamphetamine kingpin, which is a statutory designation that they applied to Tim Thacker, and gave him 40 years in federal prison. And he was a lifelong contract pilot for Delta Force who was well enmeshed in the unit, who grew up in the unit because his father was a legendary Green Beret named Gene Thacker, who himself was accused of cocaine trafficking back in the 1980s, but was acquitted when all of his teammates took the stand and testified to the uprightness of his character. So these are things, these threads you can trace back many years in terms of like lawlessness and drug trafficking in the Green Berets. But we've certainly seen an acceleration in what I would describe as, you know, a lot of smoke around this. So it's hard to find the actual fire itself because it's very difficult to get solid factual reporting on these units because they don't talk to the press. Army has no comment. JSOC has no comment. And the police do nothing to investigate these cases. They just swoop in, seize the evidence, tell everyone they're investigating, and you never hear another word breathed about the case ever again.
And lastly, I mean, another big picture theme here is not just like the failure and the immense cloud of sadness and that the war on terror has created and the trauma that it inflicts on people through others. It's generational trauma. This is also just the failure of the war on drugs that this exemplifies, and how essentially just because of this lack of oversight, these things have been able to run rampant. And I would imagine that, and you can just confirm or deny this, that people in Fayetteville and the surrounding areas and law enforcement are aware of the integration between some of these folks and the drug trafficking rings, but that it's almost just like it's good business to a degree to let it slide.
Yes, I couldn't agree with more. Couldn't agree more with what you just said. I always tell folks that the war in Mexico ought to be lumped in the same sentence with the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, because it started right around the same time. So, well, to take it back even one step before that, there was a sort of brief window in the 1990s when the U.S. Military and the federal government were kind of adrift because they really need an external enemy to oppose. That's the way that our government kind of functions. Everything is always directed towards the latest foreign boogeyman du jour, where everything is geared around opposing that, some kind of war paradigm we need in order to function in our political economy. And after the Cold War, when Russia was no longer available to serve that role, there was a time when they tried to do like the war on drugs was going to be the big national security paradigm around which everything else was organized. Now, that didn't really work very well. It didn't really test well with market audiences, so to speak. Like, it just wasn't a great paradigm. They quickly found a much, much better one in the war on terror after 2001, but the war on drugs continued apace. It wasn't as if they stopped doing that. And where it really accelerated was in Mexico around 2005 to 2010, within that window. But certainly starting with the Merida Initiative in 2008, which George W. Bush pressured, the George W. Bush administration pressured the government of Mexico to fully militarize its conflict against the cartels and fight drug trafficking cartels with overt military force. Right around the same time, they were ramping up the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's why I say they ought to be considered together, even though, of course, this conflict in Mexico was fought with Mexican troops rather than with American troops. And the result, like in Iraq, like in Afghanistan, the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people while accomplishing zero of the United States' stated objectives in those conflicts. So what we're seeing at Fort Bragg now, I think, can be understood as a kind of collapse and failure, not just of the terror wars, not just of the post-9/11 wars, but also the war on drugs, and all collapsing back and blowing back stateside in that community in Fayetteville, which is both steeped in trauma and insulated from accountability.
Well, Seth Harp, investigative reporter and contributing editor at Rolling Stone, you can read both of his pieces, but the more recent one from this month is entitled "These Kids Are Dying Inside the Overdose Crisis Sweeping Fort Bragg." Seth, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, I believe, unless we aren't. Oh, hi.
Hey, I'm back.
Oh.
We're going to head into the fun half, and I'm going to be doing a debate with writer Brad Palumbo, journalist and policy correspondent at the Foundation for Economic Education, where he is going to school me on the reasons why Joe Biden shouldn't have forgiven any student debt and shouldn't forgive any more in the future. In the meantime, head into the fun half. We're going to take some IMs, I would imagine, after that. I don't know if we'll have time for phone calls. We'll see. I'll try and keep it into a reasonable amount of time.
Unlikely.
I will do my best. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Also, the AM quickie. Get the headline news in your email box every day from a left perspective. AMQuickie.com. Sign up. It is free at the moment. Emma, ESVN this week?
Yes. Tomorrow, Bradley and I will be giving our picks for week three when we had a pretty... I went undefeated in week one. Not so much last week. Bradley had two bad weeks.
I was
weeks.
Defeated this past week.
Yeah. Tough week for us, but we look to bounce back. We'll be giving our best picks, three locks each for the weekend on Thursday at 4 p.m. on the Majority Report channel. But you can also check out our episode from earlier this week where we talked about the WNBA championship, what the heck is going on with Tom Brady. Is it right how he treats his teammates despite, you know, his prowess in the culture? And also just recapping both New York teams winning and more over the weekend. Check that out, and please rate us 5 stars on Apple iTunes and Spotify if you can do that. ESVN, check us out.
Matt! Last night on Left Reckoning, it talked to GP Jacob about rent control policies in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and also in the postgame talked a little bit about some early Glenn Greenwald blogs that might suggest that his recent jumping on Twitter to gloat over the migrants traffic to Martha's Vineyard might be more of a return to form for him on those issues. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that.
All right, we're going to head into the fun half. See you there. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it! Let's go, Brandon!
Let's go, Brandon!
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Yes?
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-85-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we've seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.